I'd like to introduce our speaker for today. I know he came from a long way, Yorba Linda, California. His name is Keith D.
Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous rooms full of people like you and a little effort on my own, I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976. And for that, I'm especially grateful. I want to welcome all you to the early bird meeting here this morning. This is Diehards. I love this slot. You know who wants to stay sober or else whoever's so crazy they couldn't sleep last night. Guy sponsor said he had a, told me the other day he had a kitty sponsors up in Billings, Montana or someplace, said that the rumor was up there I was on dope. And now I know why. Whenever the guy reads, he said we're on prayer and medication here this week. I just wanted on tape that Tom I is sitting in this meeting too. I'm glad to be here, and I'm especially glad to be sober and have an opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope. And it's a privilege to be able to participate with my wife. We got sick together, and you know, to be able to share our recovery together is a special gift of this program. And soon I get to go travel a lot, together a lot, and it's one of those fortunate things that we get to meet a lot of people and see people. There's people in this room this morning that saw me when I was new and saw Sue when she was new and knew that I was better shape than her. I always like to be in a room with people that saw Sue and I when we were new because they know who really was the sick one. and friends, Tom is especially one of my peers, and I have a good feeling about being with people that, you know, live this way of life the same as I have to, and it's just a good feeling. It's a good feeling to be sober. It's a good feeling, beautiful day, and I stop and think about the gratitude that I have for the lifestyle that we live, and it's absolutely unbelievable for me. Sometimes in my morning meditation, I stop and reflect from where I came, and that's all I got to share. I'm not an expert on anything other than messing my life up. I did it, give it the best shot I could to mess it up, and I sobered up. And after some period of time, I'm not one that came to AA and went to my first meeting and stayed sober. I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 4 years, more out than in, and finally came to Alcoholics Anonymous on May the 11th, 1976, was my first sober day, and I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since that day, and that's an important thing for me. I believe in sharing my sobriety date just for me, because I don't want you to think I've been around AA for that long. I've been in AA, because when I was around AA, I was drunk most of the time. I have a lot of gratitude. We were sharing, Lynn is Al-Anon from, used to live in California, is here, and she was instrumental when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in May of 1976, why I hit a bottom, and Sue hit a bottom, and my kid hit a bottom, and we've never needed anything but this program from that point on. We've never had any psychoanalysis or any kind of, shock treatments or gestalt therapy or anything. Primarily, we were given the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, even though Sue's an Al-Anon and Simone at that time was Alateen. I went home and I said, if I got to go to these meetings all the time, so do you. If I got to go to a meeting one day at a time, and I knew it wasn't, just one day at a time. I knew it was forever. I knew that. And I told them, if I got to do this forever, so do you. And I could intimidate my daughter at that time. She was 12 and a half, going on 13 years old. She was right at that point where she had was making a decision whether to run away from home or go with us to the program. And we all three came to the program. And we all three have lived this program totally from that point on. I believe our willingness to do what we've had to do in this program is directly proportional to the amount of pain that we went through getting here. And therefore, we went through a tremendous amount, must have a tremendous amount of pain. I was anesthetized most of the time, but Sue and Simone went through it sober. And they remember a lot of things. A lot of people like to go hear Sue because they think that they're going to, you know, hear the truth, because I'm telling it as Keith sees it, and I was blasted most of the time. But it pretty well fits, because I live with two people who watched me drink, and they don't have a problem telling me what happened. I've had a thorough inventory by my wife and daughter. My wife especially gave me probably the most detailed inventory I've ever had when I was about 8 years sober and she started menopause. Let me tell you, baby. So I know the details of it. I've lived it. And the amazing thing about it, I mean, what I have gratitude for is Lynn was instrumental, and she was chairman of a convention when Sue and Simone and I were about 2.5-3 years in the program, and we were asked to share as a family, the three of us, because there were so few families where you had an AA, an Al-Anon, and Alateen living under the same roof, who were all three in the program. And Sue and Simone and I shared at a convention in a family meeting. And man, I'm going to tell you, the gratitude I have today when I think about that and look back at that point in our life, I just have so much overwhelming gratitude for the fact that all three of us came to this program and scooped it up and live it and have from that day to now. Because it has never been anything but that. And the things that have gone on in our life, good and bad, the program has always been there. The amazing thing when I look back on that, how God works in our life, is that three of us lived in a house where there was extreme violence, extreme physical violence, not only just by the drunk, but everybody. And we came out of that madness, out of that hell, and into a lifestyle that we live today. From the point of recovery, not submission, from the point of total and absolute surrender, there has never been a time in over 18, almost 19 years that all three of us have been out of God consciousness at the same time. Now, when an active disease was going on, while there was all, you know, most of us were out of God consciousness, certainly me, when I'm a firm believer that if you take any kind of a chemical, you can no longer say, thy will be done. So anytime I put any kind of a chemical in me, I was out of God consciousness. I was in Keith consciousness, which was insanity, fear. But there has never, ever been a time from that point on when all three of us were out of God consciousness. Now today, my daughter lives in Milan, Italy. She lives halfway around the world. And we still are a family unit. Because God has no boundaries. We're a family unit. And I can stand here and say almost 19 years later, my daughter's active in the program, just as active, if not more active, than Sue and I. And Sue's active in Al-Anon, and I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there has never been a time in almost 18 years, 19 years, that all three of us are out of God consciousness at the same time. And the reason I can say that, I mean, I'm talking about what happened to me this morning. Last year, a year ago, the three of us were here, Ikipa, and my daughter was the Al-Anon speaker, and Barbara, sitting here, saw Simone when she was brand new, and she introduced Simone and saw her as a little beat-down little girl. A year ago, we were all three here, and Sue and I were here supporting Simone. She was a speaker. And I thought of that this morning in my meditation. Isn't that an amazing thing? I wake up this morning a year later, and I'm in the same place, basically, the same town. A year ago, I was here supporting my daughter, and here I'm sharing my experience supporting my wife. Excuse me. And I walk down here this morning, and the taper hands me a tape of Simone. So she's here, too. She's here, too. And that's how my God tells me that it's okay. People say, you know, well, you get nervous before you go share. If you share your experience, strength, and hope, what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like today, of course you do. Because you have to share about what it's like today. And if you share what about it's like today, well, there's a built-in thing there that we have some approach avoidance. And yet when I walk up here and the taper hands me a tape of my daughter who's halfway around the world, and it puts it right back into perspective, puts it right back in there that I know God's in her life, and it's that's God's way of saying, here's love from your daughter. It doesn't make any difference what anybody else thinks of you this morning. Your daughter loves you. And see, that's the forgiveness that I look for all my life. That's what I look for in every drink, every pill, every fix I ever took. I look for that. I look for that feeling that I had standing right over here. I didn't have my glasses on. I couldn't even see what the tape was. I had to ask Sue. But I felt something inside of me when he handed me that tape that was like, it's okay. It's okay. No matter what, it's okay. Now, I don't have anything going on in my life that is any kind of, I don't even have any unresolved problems because the steps have worked in my life. I don't have any feelings of, well, if I can just take care of this, I'll be all right. I had a feeling standing here this morning, I'm right where I'm supposed to be, doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm right on time, ain't a minute early, minute late, bam, right here. Got the right slot. And isn't it amazing when you have that kind of God consciousness? What does God give you? God gives you the icing on the cake. The icing on the cake. I'm okay with me. I'm okay with the lady I woke up with this morning. I'm okay with you. My peers are here. The people see me. And bam, I got the icing on the cake right here, man. I got that little thing that says my daughter is with me too. That's spiritual contact. That's everything I look for in every meditation I was ever given. And those little things are just like that. That ain't a big deal. It's just you just know, man. You just know it's right when that happens. God, what a fantastic feeling to have coming out of where I come. Man, when I come here, I owed over $250,000. There was two different groups of people had a contract on my life. And I'm going to guarantee you, I was as far away from the feeling I had here this morning as a person can be. I had some real approach avoidance. And I know that it takes what it takes, everything happens in God's time. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Chuck Chamberlain used to say that all the time. I was fortunate, Sue and I were fortunate, we lived close to where Chuck and Elsa Chamberlain. He's gone on to the big meeting in the sky now, and I love those kind of old-timers. I'm sure people here, some of the people in this room knew those people, but they were very instrumental in our life. And Chuck always used to say, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I thought, what are you talking about, man? This is not school. This is something, I don't know what this is. You know, I can't handle a textbook and a big book being a textbook and the teachers and all those kind of things. I'm grateful that I stayed here long enough to know what he meant. I'm grateful that I stayed here long enough to know that he said, if you could see the power of what this program can do for your life, if you could see it, the light would be so bright it'd blind you. Now, man, this old guy has flipped off, man. He's gone into something. He's senile. And yet, stand here this morning when that guy handed me that tape, I saw it. I saw it. I know that my house is in order. I know that the teachers were there. There was a family. Family, good family, beautiful people, a father, mother, little girl. They lived in Europe. And all their life, all they wanted to do, all they could dream about, all they thought about was going to America. That's all they could plan for. That was their dreams. That's all they talked about. And the father worked very hard. The mother worked very hard. He saved their money. came a time for the dream to come true, and they bought passage on a great ocean liner to go to America. And all their excitement, all the things they'd hoped for, all the anticipation that they had, all the hopes and dreams was coming true, and they'd worked hard for it, and they felt good about it, and they took all their belongings and packed them up and took what food they had some crackers and cheese, and put it in a deal and got a bag and packed the lunch for the trip, and they didn't know, they didn't have a clue what it was like, other than you go buy this ticket and you get on this great ocean liner and you sail for days and eventually you get there. And they didn't even know what they was going to do when they get there. They had all the hope in the world that their dream was going to be something great. The father loved the mother loved the father. The parents loved their child as much as any human being could love. There was no absence of love. There was nothing negative or derogatory about the whole action that was happening. They got on this great ocean liner and went to the room 3 or 4 days out on the journey. All they were eating were the crackers and cheese. After 3 or 4 days of crackers and cheese, the little girl went to her father and said, "Daddy, Daddy, I got to have something else to eat. I got to have something. I can't take crackers and cheese anymore." The father, being a good father, he reached in his pocket and took a nickel out and gave it to the little girl. She went up and said, "Go up to the galley and get an ice cream cone." She was gone about 2 hours. Pretty soon she showed up and she had a grin from ear to ear. And the father said, "My goodness, where you been? We've been worried to death about you." The little girl said, "Well, I went up the galley and I had 2 ice cream cones and I had a steak." And the father said, "My God, you can have that on a nickel?" The little girl said, "No, Daddy, the food comes with a ticket. It's free." See, this thing we're talking about here this morning comes with a ticket. That's a story about teachers. That's a story about teachers. Because the father loved the little girl, he didn't have any intention of deceiving her. He was just ignorant. You see, and that's one of the greatest things about this program is that it gives us the opportunity to live our life, to pick our teachers, to walk a path of recovery that's been set down before us by people who believe, understand, and have experienced it. Experienced it. What you do speaks so loud I can't hear a word you say. And I am so fortunate to have had some great teachers. Great teachers. Some of my teachers have taught me what I don't want. Just like a lot of newcomers. Most newcomers come through Alcoholics Anonymous to show me what I don't want because they don't stay. And I've had some great teachers that show me by their example, that if you practice these principles in all of your affairs, your life will change. Your perspective of life will change. And you will need nothing else but a simple set of spiritual tools to live a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams. For a number of years when I was hanging around here and trying to do this program and work the steps, I came to the program just totally tweaked. I mean, I was fried. And they said, "You know, you've got to get in here and surrender." Well, I'm pretty beat down. "You got to admit you're powerless." My interpretation of power was simply this. I stuck a double-barrel shotgun under a guy's chin one time, raised him up on his toes, cocked the hammers, and reached around and took his billfold out of his pocket, and I watched him wet himself. Ah, that's power. I loved it. It was like an adrenaline rush. "I've got your whole life in my hands, puke." But I was so wrong. Because I don't have him. He's got me. He's got me. I don't have a chance. And yet my whole attitude about life was like that, motivated from fear and negative feelings. I don't blame anybody for that. But I've read that if you sit and look at evil long enough, you will believe that it is no longer evil. And I drank and used to a point where everybody I hung around with lived like that. And I took my wife and my daughter with me. Because in that kind of insanity, you have to prove to them that they don't have any choices. And I took those people, well-meaning people who love me, and I took them into the gates of insanity, and we took up residency. We went to see a movie just the other day. I don't believe in outside literature or anything, but we went to see the movie Dolores Claiborne. That's my fifth step. I sit there and I thought, oh my God, I've never heard anybody stand at a podium and tell my story. I sat here. A sponsor got 17 years sober. He told me, he said, you've been hanging around with all these newcomers when you need to go with me and see a movie. He takes me to see that movie. I said, thank you. I won't go with you again for a year. Last year, he took me to see The Assassin. I sat in there and cried all the way through the thing. And it's not tears of sorrow, it's tears of joy. Unbelievable joy. That you can come out of that kind of insanity and forgive yourself and be forgiven. And that's what we're really talking about. Alcoholics Anonymous in this program, Way of Life, is not about turning it off. It's about turning it on. It's about cutting that stuff loose. It's about being able to walk out there this morning, stand out there in that beautiful day, and feel good about me. And I don't feel guilty for something that I've done or apprehensive of something I'm going to do. The amazing thing that I couldn't comprehend when I got to the program was the fact that the second step said, you know, you got to come to believe that something greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. Restore me to sanity. I said, you can't restore me to something I never had anymore. I can come back from someplace I've never been. It can't happen. Guy like me, I got paper that says I'm a sociopath. I got people that will verify that I have absolutely for years cared of no one but myself and showed no visible sign of guilt or remorse. I stood in a courtroom a year and a half before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and stayed. I stood in a courtroom, a little town up in Nevada, in front of a judge. And the judge is talking to me about me, and he's got the right guy. Got the right guy, I knew it. Standing in that courtroom, my partners had slipped me some reds. I was standing in there loaded. And the judge is talking to me about a situation that had happened some time before that, a short period of time before that day. I'd been in a bar fight, and in the bar fight, I took a man's life. Now, in that part of the country where this happened, the men were men and the sheep ran scared, so it was pretty much, you know, no man's land. And that situation went down as self-defense, justifiable self-defense, because I had witnesses that said this man threatened my life, and I defended my life. But standing in that courtroom, the judge looked at me and he said, you know, I can understand how a man can take another human being's life. I can understand how you can get in these situations. I can understand that if you live like an animal, think like an animal, look like an animal, smell like an animal, you got to defend yourself like an animal. But what I can't understand is how you can beat another human being to the point that they're not recognizable by their own family. Because in the rage and the absolutely insanity of that fight, I pounded on that body. The man was dead when he hit the ground, and I beat him to where he was unrecognizable. And the insanity inside me at that time that it was going on, as well as standing in that courtroom, was this. The wrong man died. Something's got to stop this. Don't you understand? Something has to turn this off. It should be me. I'm trying to pound my way out of this cage that I'm in. And that didn't bring me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had partners sitting in the courtroom that what that situation did to them made me a cut above, man. Somebody. And yet I'm an alcoholic. Before I knew I was an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic. You know what an alcoholic is? An alcoholic's a drunk with a conscience. A drunk with a conscience. I knew this was wrong. I knew what went on was wrong. And yet the environment that I had gone to, the point of my living and the lifestyle that I was living in, the situation that I was defending myself with and against, as simple as you stand and watch evil long enough, it will no longer seem evil, and it becomes a way of life. I'd shoot straight up out of my own bed, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. That lady sitting over there would be laying there next to me. I mean, out of a screaming nightmare, shoot straight up out of that bed, cold sweat, look at her, and know it's just a matter of time till I kill her. I gotta kill her, you know. I have to. It's part of the deal. Because she loves me. Because she loves me. Shoot up out of that bed, run down a hallway where a little 9-year-old girl is sleeping in the back of that house like a wounded animal, and run in there and put my head down by her mouth and listen to see if she's breathing. It's just a matter of time until I kill her. I got to. It's going to happen. There's nothing between me and me that can stop it. Because you either attract the things you fear the most, or you attract the things you love the most. That's it, black and white. You either attract the things you fear the most, or you attract the things you love the most. And I was attracting all the things I feared the most, living that way of life. I had no other choices. I'd made that choice. Every time I took a drink, I made that choice. And I don't love me. I hate me. And I got to prove you can't love me. So I have to destroy everything that says they love me. And isn't it amazing, the people that love us, they think that just simply saying that they love us will change what we're doing. I didn't know what love was, man. I just thought if you said you love me, it meant I was next. Whatever that took. And isn't it amazing thing, when we come to the program, work the second step, attitude of gratitude. Total change of personality. Total change. Total change. I haven't had a problem with perception since I worked the second step. You work the second step, you don't have a problem with perception. Everything about you changes. It says that in the step. My whole outlook about life has changed. Everything about me is about living a wholly, totally different lifestyle. For 4 years in and out of the program, drunk, sober, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, went to NA, all those different things, because I'm a pig, I did it all. And I said, take away my drinking. That's your job. Take away my drinking. That's your job. Now you do that. And I'd sit next to old timers and say, if you don't keep me sober, what I do when I leave here is your fault. They just laugh at me. Hey, I love old timers that look at some smart mouth like that. And they just laugh at me. Because they knew I felt guilty. They knew the guilt was killing me. And today I know that it took what it took. I had to get to a point where I had no friends, I had no enemies. No friends or no enemies. That's a fantastic place to be. I remember when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, people said, well, what am I going to do about my old friends? I didn't have to worry about that, man. They were long gone. They were gone. Even my enemies. The people had contract on me, said they found out the way I was killing me was worse than anything they could think of. They pulled the contract. And it was true. And in and out, in and out, in and out. And I'd go home and we'd get in those fights and the violence was there. And I'd be, you know, maybe try to get out of jail in the morning and go home. And by the afternoon, start a fight with Sue. And then I'd have to go get drunk because I hit her. Or because Simone got in between us and we shoved her out of the way. So on May 11, 1976, there had to be some absolutes. And those absolutes are just as absolute today as they were then. I knew it. I knew it beyond a shadow of a doubt. I couldn't even work a moral inventory on May 11, 1976. I had no clue what morals were. Fearless. I had no clue what fearless was. I knew fear only. Fear is an amazing emotion. To some people, fear is demobilizer. You see people, whenever they get afraid, they hunker down like a mule and they can't move. And then there's some of us that fears an adrenaline rush. We drive fear like a fast car. And it was just like when I'd get this, the more afraid I became, the more fear predominated me, the more when I drank alcohol, it was like an amphetamine. It just amped me up, and I just got crazier. And I knew I couldn't hit that lady anymore and stay sober. I knew the physical violence had to stop. I knew that had to stop. That was an absolute. That was an absolute. I knew not only could I not drink or use any kind of chemicals, I couldn't hit these people that said they loved me anymore. I couldn't hit anybody. And that was always my ventilation. And all of a sudden I knew. Ceased fighting everything and everybody. I haven't hit anybody in almost 19 years. And nobody's hit me. Well, one newcomer slapped me with a pool cue. But it was my fault. I was too close. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been drinking and using so much that I couldn't function as a man. You ladies can fake that. Us guys, it's obvious. And I always reached outside. I always reached out to the ladies of the evening, the one you pay to make me feel like a man. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't have got a hooker with $1,000 bill in each hand. And I knew something. I knew something on May 11, 1976. I can't cheat on that lady anymore and stay sober. Can't cheat on her and stay sober. Gotta live with me. Gotta look at me. I gotta see that alcohol and narcotics had taken me beyond a point where I was no longer even a man. Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about that all the time. Said the last thing that dies in a man is that urge. If there's no other reference point than that very thing in itself is a simple fact that I had drank until I could not function as a man. And the book says alcohol became our master. When it takes away the last thing that dies in a man, it is surely your master. And so there was an absolute. Another absolute. I had to change my whole outlook about life and what I did, the way I made a living, the way I conducted myself. And I'm grateful for the old timers that got me by the hand and said, come with us, we'll show you. Come with us, we'll show you. We won't tell you, we'll show you. I'm grateful for the old timers. I had the old timers, the kind of old timers that were more, they were more concerned about whether I was going to live or die than they were about hurting my feelings. Oh, they hurt my feelings. But they had to work at it because I didn't have very many. I didn't have very many feelings. I knew one feeling, one emotion. I used to go to meetings when I was new and I'd sit in there and the only emotion I knew was hate. I didn't understand people says, oh, I love you, but I hate you. Man, if you can't do any better than that, get out of the hate business. I hated them all. Just all of them. Just overwhelming hate. And an amazing thing, I found out through inventory that hate is not really the problem. Fear is the problem. And I knew if you found out about me, if you found out about me, I'd no longer be welcome. And I tested you. So I'd tell a little bit here and a little bit there and over here and there, and I'd drop a little clue. They'd come up and hug me. I love the old timers. When I was new, I just had that vibration. I'd sit on one of these chairs like they didn't have them hooked together, and we'd in them on concrete floors and them churches and different places. And by the time the meeting's over, I'd made a loop of the room. I was just shaking that chair around there. Just had that insane energy just going all the time. My biggest fear was I'm so crazy and I get so angry that if I weren't careful, I could find myself in an environment where I'd just get so out of whack that you could stick a drink in my hand and I'd drink it and not even know I drank it. That's the kind of anger. I used to hear people talk about, let's talk about anger. They were talking about a temper tantrum. They weren't talking about blind rage. And I'd sit there and I just absolutely afraid that something was going to happen. That I was out of control. And they'd just get me and take me and go, you sit here, you know. And after the meeting, they would hug me. and hold on. Oh, I hated them old timers that held on to me. Oh, they just hold on, you know, just hold on and wouldn't let go of me. I was sitting in the restroom this morning, Tom walked up behind me and kissed me on my ball spot. And I liked it. You see, that's a whole ball of wax. I'm a little old kid, little old boy. I was a scared little boy, and I grew up to be a scared little boy. And all I really wanted all my life was for you to say, I love you. And I didn't know what love was. Isn't it an amazing thing? This disease takes us to a place where we crave something. We have no clue what it is. I come to find out that love is an action. Love is an action for me. Through those actions, I find a love from a power greater than myself. It was always there. It was always there. I've come to know that God was always there. I didn't have to look for anything. I just had to peel away the layers of insanity and the guilt and the remorse. Get down to that point where there's absolute and total forgiveness. And when I had absolute and total forgiveness of myself, I could understand the power. And it takes time. It takes time. I'm so grateful that I didn't get the revelation and the idea and the clear picture of what I was in the very beginning. I just couldn't have stood it. It isn't that I'm afraid of going back where I come from. It's just that it's so good where I'm at, I don't want to leave. And I understand that. That's why I try to convey, if you're new or relatively new, you got to understand, I've been here over 18 years. What I share with you today is what I feel today, right now, about where I'm at. And it took 18 years. 18 years. And a tremendous amount of, you know, people. You know, we give credit when we stand up in these different deals. I don't know if they have it here. I assume they probably will. It's a countdown. I always like that because I look and see, and the closer, you know, the older you get in the program, you like those countdowns. You know, half of you says, I'm getting to be an old man. The other half says, well, at least I'm number one. But you stop and think. You stop and think a very simple, simple thing, something we don't say. Matter of fact, usually the first people that sit down are the people, the new ones. Do you have any, how long are you sober, Tom? 36? 38, I'm sorry. 38. Well, I had to ask. I didn't want to say something. But you stop and think how many alcoholics it took for Tom to get 38 years. How many alcoholics did he have to talk to? How many people came in? How many meetings did he go to early and stand and talk to some guy or gal? How many meetings did he stay late? How many conventions did he go and spend all weekend talking to somebody about this way of life that he's found? Thousands. Literally thousands. I never forget that. Never, ever forget that. I remember that. Before I remember a lot of little things that I take for granted, that my wife loves me. My wife loves me because of those countless alcoholics that came and went in my life. My wife fell in love with me in this program because she saw somebody that was so physically violent and crazy and so selfish and self-centered and neurotic and self-seeking standing over here with my arms around a guy. That is, the judge just took his wife and kids away, and I'm standing there hanging on to him, holding on to him, saying, I love you. It'll be all right. She fell in love with me because I was standing there with another alcoholic, sharing my feelings, sharing my compassion, trying to give somebody who felt hopeless hope. She fell in love with that. By the same token, for every year I've been sober, for every year I've been sober, there's three alcoholics that I've known as well as many of the people in this room who've left this program and gone and died. They literally gave their life to prove that what I'm doing is right. And I don't say that in morbid reflection. I tell you that because I don't want their death to be in vain. They would say, I don't need a sponsor. I don't need to work the steps. I don't need all these meetings. I'm going to got a new career. I'm going back to here. I'm going to do that. I'm going back with them. I'm going to go with my family. As soon as I get my family together, then I'll come back here and sit in the front row like you. And they literally gave their life to prove that what I'm doing today is right. I'll never forget those people. Or the countless newcomers. I work with a lot of young people. Sue and I are fortunate. We work with a lot of young people, sponsor them and help them in our home groups. There's young men in my home group who sobered up at 15, 16 years old. Now, I could have used Alcoholics Anonymous full-blown at 15, 16 years old. I guarantee you. I know that. And so I'm willing to help some of these young guys, street guys. Young guys come off the streets of L.A. out there where they've been selling their butt to get a drink or fix. And for every one of those young men that's got 10 years of sobriety, there's 15 of them in my home group, a group of 50, 60 guys. There's 15 young men in there who will have over 10 years of sobriety this year. And for every one of them that's got 10 years of sobriety, 100 came and left. 100 came and left. 100 young people came through there. For every one that stayed sober 10 years, there's 100 went through there. Now, what is it? If there's anything that sometimes in my prayer and meditation, I say, God, give me the ability to accept that. Because sometimes it's so good, I almost feel like, well, I must have something that they don't, I must be have been given something that they can't see, to be able to see something, to do something. There must be some special gift. And when I have those thoughts, I know it's just the self. Because I know, I really know, I live with an Al-Anon. You live with an Al-Anon, well, you'll know. You know how powerless you are. But I'm an alcoholic and I have those thoughts. And when I have those thoughts, I think of that third step. The power, the absolute power of the third step is beyond anything I ever imagined. Relieve me of bondage of self. Give me the strength. The strength. To do your will. I got a new employer. I got a new boss, man. I got a new boss. I don't have to worry about it. I haven't had to worry about anything since I sobered up. There's nothing to worry about. Because when I look back on my life, everything turned out better than anything I would have planned it. And so what I was worrying about wasn't even necessary to worry about. And a lot of the things that I worried about last year weren't even worth worrying about because nothing happened and I worried in vain. Well, I worried because my grandpappy used to say, you should worry. A guy like you should worry a little bit. My life has not changed any way whatsoever, but better since I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, there's been times, there's been some rough times. Don't get me wrong, there's some times I wanted to drink. I got thirsty. Oh, I believe the animal's in the cage, the door ain't locked. Oh, I'll go back to that. I'll go right back to that. I believe that motor's running, just waiting to be bumped in gear. I think it's sitting there. It'll come. I went to a dentist, and the dentist wanted to give me some codeine, and I'd been sitting there, I'm tough. Go ahead and pull another one. Pulled about three of them suckers and sent me out in the front office. Said, here, you want this prescription for codeine? I'm drooling down the side of my face thinking, you dummy, you know you could have had one a day pulled or one a week pulled or one a year pulled, but no, not you. You had three pulled so that you can stand here and say, no, I don't need anything. Thank you very much. I'll handle it on my own. Stumble out and get in my car and cry because the pain is so excruciating. And I think, what did I do that for? Because I wanted to test myself and see if I could say no to the dope. I didn't know that when I walked in that room. I've had those days. Had those surrenders with money, property, prestige, people, places, and things. But what a magnificent surrender. Because what it gave me what I looked for in all my life. It gave me the very thing, the thing I looked for in the fourth and fifth step. The thing that I didn't even understand in the fourth and fifth step was, what is the fourth and fifth step supposed to do for me? I couldn't understand. How are you supposed to do a fearless inventory? How are you supposed to do a moral inventory? How are you supposed to look at these things? I can't even see anything. I'm a pathological liar. I can't tell you the truth. And you want me to do this inventory and see what part I play? There's many things in my life that I came out of, the whole life that I came out of. Many things that I could not see the part I played in until I was 6 or 7 years sober. 6 or 7 years sober. I remember at 6 years, 4 months, and 3 days sober, I went to Chuck Chamberlain's house. Now that guy at that time was sober well over 30 years. And he looked at me and said something silly like, "Well, you realize that a character defect's not a character defect until it causes you pain. Your character defects could be caught driving everybody around you crazy, but if it don't bother you, man, it just don't bother you, and it ain't a character defect. So whenever you run against the wall, whap, there it is, that's you. Now what are you going to do about it? You going to change? Or are you going to say, 'I'm sorry?'" Oh, man, I'd rather say I'm sorry. I'd much rather say I'm sorry. I've been sorry all my life. It don't mean anything to say I'm sorry. But change? What do you mean change? Man, I run around Alcoholics Anonymous the first few years I was sober. Every group, whatever that group was, I'd go to the doctor's group, I'd be a doctor, I'd dress like a doctor. I'd go to the biker's group, I'd dress like a biker. I'd go over to some for the psychiatrist group, the lawyer's group. I run around Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have any identity. I'd go to a group. What is this group? Well, I'll be like this group, you know. And I didn't know. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had long hair, long beard, didn't wear underwear or socks. You know, I didn't take time out for the things that hindered you in a moment of notice. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I was searching. I could have posed for a family portrait when I got here. I didn't know if I was Frank or Ernest. My wife used to, Saturday mornings were bad. She'd get up and run in there, bam, call up Lynn or somebody, you know, be talking on the phone. I'm running around the house trying to figure out who I am, where I'm going. And I remember my sponsor said, "You're an alcoholic, you're going to a meeting." Okay. So I'd go in and I'd, you know, say, "Well, I'm from Texas." I put on my cowboy suit. So I'd put on my Levi's, my boots, and get my vest on, you know, and my cowboy hat, get in front of the mirror and do a couple of shit howdies, you know. Run out, kiss her goodbye, go out and get my pickup truck, take off down the street, get about 4 miles from the meeting, and think, "Nah, I ain't a cowboy today." I'd turn around and I'd go back, run inside, take off my cowboy outfit and go in there and say, "Well, I'm a biker today." So I'd go and get my leathers on, my bandana, get in front of the mirror and do a couple of riv-ups and say, I'm gonna get my Harley out and I'm gonna roar down that meeting, drive it right up them old-timers' ass. I'd run out, kiss her goodbye, go fire my Harley up and run around the neighborhood and make all the neighbors crazy and wake them up. They're supposed to be up anyway. Get down there and hit a light and the mirror would be vibrating. I'd look at myself in the mirror of that Harley and, "Nah, I'm kind of a marshmallow today." I'd turn around, drive it back home, go in and think, "I know, I'm somebody." I'd take off my Harley stuff, get my three-piece suit out, get my dictionary out, look at some of them $75 words, say them 3 or 4 times in front of the mirror, you know, so I could have some big word to pass on to the group. Run out and kiss her goodbye. She'd be still on the phone talking to some old-timer, you know, looking at me, and I'd go out and get my big AA car. Head for the meeting. I'd get about a block from the meeting. Forgot them $75 words. Can't go in there dressed like that if you can't talk like it. Go in there and talk like a biker or Texan. You got to have them $75 words. You're going to wear a three-piece suit. I have to go back home, pull in the driveway. You know, take off my suit, go in, put on my jogging outfit, you know, and get my jogging on and stand in front of the mirror and jog and run out and kiss her goodbye and jog to the meeting. Wonder why newcomers are tired when they get to a meeting? They had 3 or 4 identity crises. One time, Sue was talking to somebody and said, "How many people live in that house?" I said, "Oh, just the alcoholic. You don't know who he is today. But he's got it down to 4. I mean, that's fun. At the time, it seemed like it was crazy. See? But I'd get there and I could have 3 or 4 different deals. What do you want to do today? I can do it all. Where do you want to go? I'm so grateful Sue worked the program good enough. She could say, ain't he cute? There he goes. There goes that alcoholic, man. Whoa. Eating that sugar. You got to eat a lot of sugar when you're new. We went in there, me and Big Rods went to a restaurant after meeting one night and ordered a piece of pie. Brought out a menu thing, said, well, we got different kinds of pie here. Said, how much is a piece of pie? A piece of pie is $2.50. Big Rod says, how much is the whole pie? Well, the whole pie is $3. Bring 2 pies. Eat a whole cherry pie, go home and lay in bed all night thinking. I don't think about should I eat in the pie. I mean, that's past. I'm thinking about I should have saved a piece for in the morning. I was standing in an old meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous down at the old Anaheim Alano Club, still there. I love them old Alano clubs. I don't have no problem against detoxes. Sobered up in a detox. Couldn't have made it no other way. Don't have no problem with that. I love them old Lano clubs. I go to them Lano clubs. Man, that was great. I could go in there and sit down and look around. I guarantee if you're wondering if you're an alcoholic, drop by and one of them Lano clubs and sit in there for about 15 minutes. You'll know you're an alcoholic because if you wasn't, you wouldn't even be there. My sponsor wouldn't even sit next to me. He'd stand on the other side of the room, and when newcomers would come in, he'd capture them and talk to them about me. See him? See him? Watch him. Watch him. He's crazy. I caught one of them newcomers one time, and I said, what did my sponsor say about me? He said, if I go back out and drink, I could end up like you. I hated him. I was going to a meeting one night with my sponsor. He came to a red light, hit a red light. And I had a gun in my boot. I took it out and I started playing with it. He was so into himself, he didn't notice. And I said, I got to know about God. You got to help me with God. If I don't get a God, I'm not going to make it. I need a God. Tell me about God. Give me your God. You got a God? I know you got a God. You've been here longer than me. I need to know about God. And he just looked at me with that disgusting look. If you'll shut up. He always looked at me with that look. Sponsors have always looked at me with that look. I always have a sponsor that's sober longer than me enough so they can look at me with that look and say, if you'll just shut up, it'll happen. And he pointed at a guy across the street standing at a red light. And he said, see that guy over there? I said, yeah. He said, you want to kill him? And I said, I don't even know him. Don't want to kill him. He said, for you, that's growth. That's spiritual. You got a God in your life. I went to a meeting one night, had a book study, and they were reading a spiritual experience in the back of the book. I was sober about a year and a half, and I had the heat was on. I owed a lot of money. And it was due. Guy said he had a spiritual experience. He went to church, and the deacons of the church, he shared with them that he needed $1,000, and the deacons of the church said, well, we got a gentleman in the congregation that has a lot of money, and he makes that money available for necessary, needy cases that the congregation believes is worthwhile. And in your case, why, this man's volunteered to give you $1,000 anonymously, and here's a check for $1,000. And the guy came back to the AA meeting and shared that night. As we read that spiritual experience in the back of the book, he shared how he'd been given $1,000 and a miracle had happened. I jumped straight up in the meeting. I said, I want to know when I'm going to get my miracle. I need about $250,000 now. My sponsor said, go home, look in the mirror. You are a miracle. I went home, looked in the mirror. I looked. Somebody was looking back. Blew me away. I had an intuitive thought. Standing there in front of that mirror, I had an intuitive thought. I looked in that mirror, someone was looking back, and I said, I know where I can get that money. Next day, I took a plane, went back to Texas where I grew up. There's a little young man that I grew up with. He was a couple of years younger than me, one of them rich little boys. I jerked his pants down one time in front of a bunch of girls down at the park. I wasn't a bully, but I was close. Embarrassed him, had to apologize to him. My grandpappy made me go apologize to him because my whole family had to do business with his father, who owned a bank in half the county. Here I am, a little over a year sober. I'm sitting in this kid's office. He'd inherited his father's business, and he owned half the county, multimillionaire, sitting there in the bank. I'm a year and a half sober. So I don't know how I got here, don't know what I'm doing here, but I'm sober. He said, I heard. They didn't trust that either. That really had nothing to do with what the conversation was about, because I'd been sober before. They'd seen that. But I had to let him know that I'm sober. I said, I need $250,000. I don't have much to put down as collateral. He looked me right in the eye. You see, this is why I know when I looked in that mirror and I saw somebody was home, I knew where to get the money. And that kid looked me right in the eye, and he looked me right square in the eye. And he said, remember that day when you took my pants down in front of the girls? Yeah. He said, I have never forgotten that. And I knew when I looked in that mirror that I could stand that. And he said, I'll loan you that money. Reached in his drawer and pulled out a checkbook. He said, here, go write the checks, pay your bills. Let me know when you're through. He said, if you miss one payment, I'll kill you. That's an incentive program. That didn't bother me, because if I didn't make a payment, I was going to die. So, you know, the ye and the yaw is just pretty evident here. You know, so another one wants to kill me. You're giving me money. And I walked out of that bank and I thought, I wonder if I could take this checkbook, cut a check for about 40 grand, go to Borneo and drink near beer. You know, I didn't want to pay their damn bills. When I got the money, it was the most important thing in my life. When I got it, I didn't want to make the payment on it. And I went and made those payments because I'd changed. And I looked in that mirror, and what I saw was there was somebody there that had the strength to do what was right. It took me 12 years to pay that back. 12 years. And I paid it all back. I missed one payment near the end, and I called him up. I said, I'm going to be late on a payment. And I remember what you said. And he said, well, you have done so good that I recognize that what I said to you that day sitting in my office was wrong. He said, I know you're sober, and I know you're taking care of your family. And that's all I ever wanted for you anyway. He said, pay the rest when you can. Isn't that amazing? A guy had a resentment for over 20 years of me because of something I did. And by the fact that I did the right thing, he made an amends. He was relieved of his resentment towards me because I did the right thing. Because I made those payments. I made those payments to him. It changed his life. Changed his perspective about Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober about 7 years. I was a chairman. I was on a committee, one of these conventions. I was the head sick. I was chairman, Mr. Big. Had 350 people on my committee. We met once a month. Everybody gave their report, and I judged it. Couldn't say anything because they're alcoholics and they don't hear. They do it anyway. They do whatever they're going to do. All the committees, they just do it. You got to get out of the way and let them do it, and then everything will be all right. I knew that. So after my job as chairman was after the meeting, after we'd have the committee meetings, I cleaned up. My sponsor said that'll always induce a little humility if you clean up after everybody's gone. So I did that. I'm the cleanup man, and I'm cleaning up, and I found a billfold. Found a billfold. Now, the old me would have reached in there and took the money out of that billfold. There was $300 or $400 in that billfold. It was kind of an organizer kind of a thing. Had credit card, checkbook, a calendar. I recognized the name as I went by it. Wanted to take that money and throw that billfold right in the trash can. The old me would have done that. But because of the actions I was taking in Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the actions of service, I couldn't do it. I had the thought, I just didn't act on it. I called the guy up and met him and gave him that billfold back. He was on the committee of that convention. He was in charge of entertainment. He was a thespian, you know, be actor, model, all that stuff. And he was on the entertainment committee, and his name was Peter. And I gave him back that book, and he looked at me, and he said, I am so grateful you gave me that. I would have been lost without my calendar. I wouldn't have known what to do, my money, everything, and money's here. He kind of looked at me like, the money's here. And I had that immediate thought, yeah, and you could give me a reward, Hoss. But looking at you, I'm pretty sure you're not. I didn't say nothing. And he said, if there's ever anything I could ever do for you, let me know. In all my arrogance and judgment, I looked at him and I said, there'll never be anything you can do for me. You better be glad you got that back. I never said a word, but those thoughts just rolled. Four years later, my daughter, little girl, rolled out of the back of that house, beat down like a wounded animal. She had fulfilled a dream. Her dream when she went to Alateen, when she got out of the madness, her dream was to be a model. I don't know where it came from. How can you take something that's so ugly, so twisted, and so beat down that you can't even see her eyes through the hair, that never changed clothes, that wore the same clothes all the time, that lived in the back of a house like a wounded animal? What deep down inside could possibly make that thing with no self-worth and no hope whatsoever want to be something that would stand on a stage and change clothes all the time? But God. Is that odd or is that God? 4 years after I gave that guy that billfold, my daughter left Los Angeles. We took her to the airport. She wanted to be a model. She was going to the Orient. She was going over there on a contract that I didn't think she could fulfill. But it was a dream. I was so fearful for what she was doing that I couldn't even enjoy what was happening. I didn't even understand the difference between fear and joy. And yet we took her to the airport, and she had all these suitcases, and she got on the plane, and away she went. She went over two or three places, ended up in Milan, Italy, and got sick because she didn't know what she was doing. Couldn't speak Italian. Got in some room over there with very little money. Got a round-trip ticket. Already used half of it. Stayed in there for 6 weeks or more. We never heard from her. Didn't know whether she was dead or alive. Somewhere after being there for a period of time, she reached out and called Alcoholics Anonymous. She's not an alcoholic. She's an Al-Anon. That time her career was trying to push the need for the program out, so she hunkered down. And when she couldn't stand it any longer, she called Alcoholics Anonymous, and people told her, well, there's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. She went. It was an Italian-speaking meeting. She couldn't even communicate. But there was a gentleman in that meeting who told her about another AA meeting the next night, and he could speak English, and he came and got her and took her to the meeting the next night. In that meeting the next night, there were about 15, 16 people sitting around the room. They went around the room, and in Milan, Italy, there's not that much program, and so they're hungry for anything. And when they came to her, she said, I'm an Al-Anon. I don't know, I can't share in an AA meeting. And they said, if you'll talk program, we'll let you. We're so hungry for it, just share. I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous in places where they're not so snubby that they won't allow somebody to share. Because sitting in that meeting, my daughter shared a little bit of her story, and after the meeting was over, a young man came up to her and said, is your dad named Keith Drum? She said, yeah. He said, my name's Peter. I owe him a favor. I was going to leave Italy today, and for some reason I stayed. I didn't know why. I didn't have any work. But for some reason I stayed. I'm going to stay another week. I'll take you home tonight. I'll come and get you tomorrow, show you where the other models live. I'll show you where you can get tapes to learn how to speak Italian. I'll show you the ropes, and then I'll go home and I'll tell your mom and dad you're okay. You see, if I'd have stolen that $300 or $400 and thrown that billfold in the trash, it could have cost my daughter her life. And I'll tell you something even bigger than that. I told you that Chuck said if you could see the power, it would blind you. I'll tell you something bigger than my daughter's life. Today, right now, this minute. My daughter lives in Milan, Italy. She's a very active member of Al-Anon. She's helped the Al-Anons over there translate the American literature into Italian. They lose a lot in the translation with the hand. She started speaker meetings over there. They didn't have any speaker meetings. They didn't have any tapes. She helped somebody get a tape player, and she took tapes over there, and they translated them. And she started meetings where the family can come and have those eating meetings. And she started all kinds of meetings. She's involved with service, world service. Once a week, she goes all the way to a NATO base, rides a train, 2 or 3 hours on a train, pays $20-$30 one way. Sponsors 6 or 8 young girls, takes them over there to a NATO where military people who can't get off the base, and she takes program in there and shares with them, and she rides that train back 2 or 3 hours, $20-$30 on a trip back. Every week she does that. Now, I told you in 38 years that Tom's been here how many thousands of people it took for him to get that 38 years. Imagine how many thousands of people would have been deprived of this program had I stole that $300 or $400. Had I stole that $300 or $400 out of that billfold and thrown it in the can, not only would I blemished Alcoholics Anonymous, but the commitment and service, aside from the fact that I might have drank behind it. Nor would Peter had an opportunity to share with my daughter and save her life. Nor would he had the opportunity to come back and tell us that she's okay. And he's still in Alcoholics Anonymous today, and so am I. My daughter still lives in Italy, and she shared with thousands, literally thousands of people, our story. And carried the message of this program. Joe and Charlie were over there doing a book study in Germany. And Simone went all the way from Milan, Italy, over there, took a bunch of girls, and they went to a convention in Germany and shared. And people came up to Joe and Charlie and said, "Do you know this young lady, this Al-Anon?" And Joe and Charlie said, "I know their mother and their father." Greatest compliment you could ever get. So you see, what you do today, you have a choice. I have a choice. I have so many reference points that are just like that. Those are God's stories. Those are little actions that I took in that moment of thought that should I do me the old way I used to be, or shall I try something different? Shall I try to be somebody I don't know how to be? Shall I be that transparent human being that knows the difference between right and wrong? I know right. I know wrong. I know that. I've got a conscience. Shall I do the right thing and see how far it goes? Don't cheat yourself out of that. God, that's what you look for all your life. That's what I beg for. And every time I sit in one of them churches on Sunday morning trying to get that fix from God, all I wanted to see was how far it can go. And yet out of my own ignorance, because of the alcoholism, I couldn't see. I couldn't hear. I couldn't feel. And so I condemned God. And I judged God. And I belittled God in contempt. What a fantastic God we have. What an unbelievable God I work for to let me see how far, how powerful, how beautiful, how exciting. I love the enthusiasm. I love the enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is God within. I love the feeling inside of me of knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt we're right where we're supposed to be, doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing together. To have the patience to endure my blessings. One of the greatest acts of love is to have the patience to endure your blessings, even though you can't see them, you can't feel them, and you can't hear them. I'm as sober as I am secret. I got no secrets in my life today. I'm transparent. What a freedom. No secrets. We talk about gossip. You know, if you have no secrets, there is no gossip. You got no secrets, there is no gossip. I'm not doing anything today or any yesterday or the day before that I can't stand here and let you see. You gave me that freedom. I didn't even know I wanted it. Don't cheat yourself out of this thing. Don't settle for crackers and cheese, man. You don't have to settle for crackers and cheese. What we got here, what you can have here, what you can put into your life, what you can be, what you can feel, it comes with the ticket. It comes with a ticket. You earned it. You deserve it. You can have it. Just don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. Don't judge what's happening today. Let it happen 3 days. Let it happen 3 weeks, 3 years. Give yourself that reward. Everything has to have a reward. I don't do anything without some kind of reward. Sometimes it seems like the things I do is like a carrot out there. But I'm in the race. I'm in the deal. And all my life I wanted to be in the deal. Deal me in, man. 50 cents, 50 million. Deal me in. And I'm in the deal. And so are you. Just don't settle for the things. Check the teachers out. Look to what they're doing. Ask yourself, is this what I want to be? Put yourself into this program. Throw yourself into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Try to live this way of life in all your affairs. Give it everything you got. Don't take much, just everything you got, but it's worth it because that's the only thing that you got that's yours. And someday you'll see, and you'll know, and you'll believe. It's right on time, right where it's supposed to be, doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing. And then you'll know the absolute power and the strength of the 11th step. There's old timers around here that say if you work the first 9 steps, you don't ever have to work them again. You can throw them away. I thought, not me. That's hokey. I need to get back in there in that 4-step and dig up a little crap. Put a little mustard on the deal. I've come to understand today that I live in the power and the strength of that 11th step. Very simple, because I don't live like I used to. If you don't live like you used to, then you don't need to work those 9 steps over and over and over again, because my life has changed. I'm not what I used to be, but I've never forgotten where I come from, because I never forget every day when I wake up. The animal's in the cage, and the door's not locked. And I simply say to my God, you better take care of me because I'm going to be real busy. And let's see what we can see and be what we can be, because that's all I ever wanted to be. God bless and thank you.